27-year-old Palestinian citizen from Tulkarm in the West Bank. Anan was arrested without charge or justifiable cause by the Italian police in the central Italy mountain city of L'Aquila on January 29 on an extradition request by the Israeli government, which Italy's justice ministry acquiesced straight away. A month later, Anan, who holds a valid residence permit in Italy since 2017, is still detained in a prison wing housing only terrorists in the city of Terni.
Anan's detention is similar to Israel's administrative detention, when a person is kept in prison without trial, without having committed an offence. Israel even wants to intimidate the Palestinians who live abroad.
Israel believes Anan has committed one and only very serious offence. He has not given up the fight. That's why they are behind him. Italy is surveillance subservient as usual with Israel. Our authorities have arrested an innocent man who is just a member of the Palestinian resistance.
During the demonstration, activists strongly condemned Italy's government for its complicity in the genocide in Gaza.
We know full well how heavy Israel's influence is on the Italian government. Prime Minister Meloni wanted to ban pro-Palestine demonstrations. We have seen her going hand-in-hand with Netanyahu.
More pro-Palestine protests will be held in Italy at the weekend. Large demonstrations will take place in Rome, Florence and Pisa. Meanwhile, a group of Italian lawmakers announced they will travel to the Rafah border between the Gaza Strip and Egypt. They say they want to provide the Italian government with a testimony of the tragedy the Palestinians are experiencing as a result of Israel's crimes. Max Civili, Rome.
The new satellite Pars 1 aboard Soyuz launch vehicle was blasted off from a Russian space base and successfully put into orbit 500 kilometers above Earth. The imaging and research satellite will provide a set of remote sensing data that can be used in various fields, including land, forest, water monitoring, and mining and energy transmission lines. The domestically made satellite weighs nearly 150 kilograms and is capable to capture images of 95% of Iranian territory.
The Pars 1 satellite is a two-way researching satellite built by the Iran Space Research Institute and has three types of applications for collecting data from the Earth's surface. The first payload of the color spectrum with an accuracy of 15 meters, the second payload with an accuracy of 150 meters for thermal imaging, and a payload with 300 meters accuracy for imaging with shortwave infrared spectra, which is used to identify plant and forestry pests.
Some Iranians gathered in the country's Space Research Institute to watch the event and express their thoughts about this launch.
We're very proud of this moment. This cooperation between the two countries shows the country's development in international interactions.
I came here today to see this proud moment, and I hope that in the future I can play an influential role in Iran's technological developments.
Pars 1 is designed and manufactured by experts and young scientists with the cooperation of knowledge-based companies. This is the second foreign launch of Iranian satellite. Last year, Iran launched Khayyam satellite from a space launching pad in Kazakhstan. Iran is among the world's top 10 countries capable of developing and launching satellites.
The latest launch is an important step forward in the country's space program. Despite sanctions imposed by Western countries in recent years, Iran is excelling in a wide range of technological developments, including in the space sector. Farzan Ashuryon, Tehran.
Pakistan's newly elected lower house of the parliament met for the first time on Thursday with freshly elected members taking oaths amid protests on the floor by the supporters of jailed former Premier Imran Khan. They called for an audit of the recently held polls in the country.
We will bring back our beloved leader Imran Khan along with the mainstream leadership of our party with the power vested in the newly formed parliament. We demanded on the floor of the House that the chief election commissioner and officials of the electoral body should step down immediately because they were involved in poll rigging and manipulation of results.
Although candidates supported by the imprisoned Khan secured the majority of seats in the country's National Assembly, the Pakistan Muslim League Nawaz and Pakistan People's Party, along with their political allies, have united in an alliance to establish a coalition government. They have nominated former Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif as their candidate for the country's chief executive position for a second term. Khan's opponents say that the democracy has emerged victorious, while those setting up obstacles in the way of country's progress and prosperity have been defeated.
We consider Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf as a roadblock to the country's progress and prosperity. They are attempting to sabotage democracy through the rhetoric of poll rigging and are striving to foment anarchy in the country.
Efforts from the government coalition to persuade its former key ally have encountered a hurdle with the leader of Pakistan's primary religious political faction, affirming its decision to refrain from participating in the formation of the government. Once the head of the former coalition, the chief of Jamiat Ulama-e-Islam, Maulana Fazlur Rahman, parted ways with the newly formed coalition and decided not to be involved in forming the new government.
A hung parliament in Pakistan has been sworn in amid allegations of poll rigging and results manipulation. Experts say that the formation of a coalition government in the country with a split mandate would face severe political challenges in the days to come. Nasik Azmi, Islamabad.
As a result of a broad consensus in Iraq to end the presence of U.S.-led international coalition forces from the country, both the Iraqi nation and government made it crystal clear that these military forces are no longer needed. Iraqi National Security Advisor Qasem al-A'raji stated that all political factions in the country have agreed on the need to end the presence of U.S.-led military coalition purportedly formed to fight Daesh terrorist group.
Today, we're witnessing the negotiation with the international coalition forces, and honestly, what makes us, the Iraqi people, exasperated is the insistence by the U.S. to keep its troops on our land to have an intervention in the military scene of Iraq and neighboring Syria.
Iraqi Prime Minister Mohammed Shia al-Sudani stated that the Western Alliance mission will end at the Baghdad government's official request. He also said that the government is setting a date for the start of bilateral committee talks, which includes representatives of the military coalition to put arrangements to end the presence of international coalition forces in Iraq permanently.
We have collected more than 100 signatures and prepared the legal draft to end the international coalition mission in Iraq. And we pledge before God to our people that we will enact the law to expel the foreign forces from our land.
The demands to end U.S. military presence in Iraq are not new. After Washington's assassination of top Iraqi and Iranian anti-terror commanders, General Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mehdi al-Muhandis 4 years ago, Iraqi parliament voted to expel foreign forces who can endanger security and stability in Iraq and jeopardize civil peace.
Following the recent attacks on anti-terror forces and the continued violations on the country's sovereignty, the Iraqi nation and government are now determined to end the presence of foreign military forces to prevent any further escalations that can endanger the stability and security of Iraq. Muslim Salem, Baghdad.
Celebrating Iran's efforts and the evolution of its multilateral cooperation over the past century,
The virtual exhibition of images, documents, and videos, entitled Iran in 100 Years of Multilateralism, looks at key milestones and achievements of Iran as an active member in international organizations, illustrating them with rarely seen historical photos, documents, and contemporary visuals.
The idea of setting up an exhibition like this one was proposed about 7 months ago. The main objective was to create a reliable source for research purposes. However, when we started collecting information and documents, we realized that the role that Iran has played in international organizations has been so significant that it deserves to be presented to the public.
This is also in line with Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi's approach.
Multilateralism is very important. It is the only way to circumvent U.S. sanctions. Our people should be united, and I'm pleased to see that Iran is promoting multilateralism. BRICS is a symbol of this new policy, giving the Global South a voice.
This comes as the foreign minister has just wrapped up a two-day trip to Geneva, packed with bilateral meetings, not only with his counterparts from different countries from around the world discussing issues of bilateral concern, but also with high-ranking officials in the United Nations, including UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, the High Commissioner for Human Rights, and President of the International Committee of the Red Cross, ICRC, all in line with rallying support for Palestinians under constant Israeli attacks.
I'm here in Geneva to reiterate Iran's stance on the current developments. Our government's policy is based on creating a network of cooperation and promoting multilateralism, because we believe this is the best way to overcome the challenges that we are facing.
Meanwhile, Iran's foreign minister used the opportunity to draw attention to Israel's long history of unlawful behavior during the UN conference on disarmament.
The Iranian foreign minister called on the international community to demand the immediate nuclear disarmament of the Israeli regime.
And the special high-level meeting held on the sidelines of the 55th session of the UN Human Rights Council on the dire humanitarian situation in Gaza once again highlighted Iran's role as a country that prioritizes multilateral cooperation. Gisumisha Ahmadip, Geneva.
Palestinians have taken to the streets across the occupied West Bank to protest against the Israeli genocide on the Gaza Strip as it nears 150 days. Despite the bad weather and heavy rain, protesters roam the streets of Ramallah chanting for Gaza and demanding an end to Israel's war on the besieged Strip. People here say that Israel is using the war on Gaza to escalate its military measures in the West Bank.
Despite the Israeli non-stop crimes against our people and attempts to break their will, the Palestinians there in Gaza are steadfast and the resistance is still fighting. Wherever the Palestinians are, they are facing the Israeli illegal plans and violence and the killing that is everywhere, settlement expansion, Judaization attempts, and now the Israeli plans of eviction and attempts to break the resistance in Gaza that all Palestinians are embracing.
Also, amongst the demands of the Palestinian protesters is to shed the light to the suffering of the thousands of prisoners incarcerated in Israeli jails under inhumane condition. In addition to the fact that the Israeli regime is using the illegal administrative detention that allows it to keep Palestinians behind bars without charge or trial.
Prisoners are being held under a disastrous situation in Israeli jails. 7,300 were detained from the West Bank and over 2,000 from the Gaza Strip since the 7th of October. And we should not forget that over 4,000 have already been imprisoned before. So we're talking today about over 11,500 prisoners who are being tortured, humiliated, and maltreated. Hundreds are in serious health condition, and they're facing a slow death.
With all eyes are focused on the Gaza Strip, Israeli regime continues stepping up its violence here in the occupied West Bank. The Israeli forces shot dead 4 Palestinians in separate incidents in Al-Farah refugee camp and Tobas town, northeast Nablus, and at Mazmouria checkpoint near Bethlehem, bringing the number of Palestinians killed in the West Bank since the start of the war on Gaza to 411. Protesters today are stressing that no one is getting used to the Israeli genocide in the besieged Gaza Strip. At the time when the regime's atrocities against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank are on the rise, they say this is the least they can do to express their anger, to express their support to their fellow Palestinians in Gaza, and to show them that they are not alone. Mona Qandil, Occupied Ramallah.
As India prepares for the world's largest elections in a few months, a research group has recorded alarming spike in anti-Muslim hate speech across the country. The US-based India Hate Lab said hate speech rose by 62% in the second half of 2023 in India compared to the first 6 months of the year. The states where most anti-Muslim hate speeches were recorded are Maharashtra, Uttar Pradesh and Madhya Pradesh. Considered the biggest voter bases of Prime Minister Narendra Modi's Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party, other states governed by BJP were not immune either.
It's actually all about the elections, as the ruling party want to retain the power. They don't want to lose this election. They are frustrating the largest Muslim community, and the minority has become an easy tool. They are distracting people from actual crisis the country is facing, and for them, provoking the religious sentiments of the people. Through hate speeches and targeting of Muslims have become election winning issue, especially for large political parties like BJP.
India Hate Lab says it compiled data of incidents reported by Indian media and tracked online activity of Hindu nationalist groups. In recent months, a similar research group, the Hindutva Watch, was blocked in India by a controversial Information Technology Act. Critics accused the ruling party of failing to address growing incidents of violence and hate campaigns against the Muslim community. They allege Modi's ruling party of stigmatizing critics, using laws and enforcement agencies while distracting people from real issues facing the country.
Basically, the present government, who is at the center of the country, basically they don't have any issue related to the people. They don't have a development agenda. So they think that to divide the country on the basis of Hindu and Muslims and to polarize the Hindus, that the best tool is hate speeches. Unfortunately, all the people, those who are giving hate speeches, they are all related to Sangh Parivar.
As the largest minority group in India, Muslims have long been facing social, political and economic marginalization. Rights groups say India's ruling party BJP in recent years have also adopted various laws and policies that have legitimized violence against minorities. The groups allege that mistreatment of Muslims and other minority groups have grown exponentially under Prime Minister Modi, who assumed office in 2014 and is widely expected to retain power after the 2024 elections.
Elections are usually a thrilling experience for any democracy, which experts describe as a phase of transition for a nation's future in the right direction. Observers say in India, it's all about patronizing the majority by polarizing the voters, and religion plays a key role. They say the ruling party's newly enacted laws related to the minorities are turning detrimental for India's secular credentials. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
On Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure. From wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans, and I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely Thou art the all-forgiving, the all-compassionate.
Bring us on from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. Millions of Iranians have headed to polling stations to cast their ballots in the 12th parliamentary elections and the 6th elections for the Assembly of Experts since the victory of the Islamic Revolution back in 1979. All through the past 45 years, elections have been a main pillar of Iran's democracy, which is rare, if not unique, in the West Asia region. Top Iranian officials say huge turnout in the elections will give the country great advantages in the international arena. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has also emphasized that people's participation in the voting will make friends of the nation happy and will disappoint the ill-wishers. Let's see how the latest round of elections could affect the country and what effects it could have on the region as a whole. Joining us on tonight's Spotlight, we have academic and political analyst Hakim Esari Birya, joining us from the Iranian capital, Tehran. And also joining us from Lebanese capital, Beirut, we have Iranian affairs expert, Mr. Karim Sharar.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to the program. Let's start off with Miss Sally Biria in Tehran. A record number of candidates, around 15,000, have been approved to run in the parliamentary elections this year. That's a record, as we know it, since the 1979 Islamic Revolution. What does this say about this year's elections?
Yes, this year's election is a historic one because of the very different era that we are actually witnessing the election to take actually happen. We are experiencing this election in a time when the world is experiencing very, very important developments in terms of what is happening in West Asia, what is happening around the world in terms of global order, in terms of the decline of the American front, and of course in terms of Iran internally, because of the coming together of the Iranian people against all the different challenges that the Iranian people have had over the past 45 years, but especially over the past few years, because of the hybrid warfare that the Iranians have experienced from the American front, and especially in terms of the propaganda warfare that has been, Iranians have been bombarded by this information warfare, this misinformation warfare, especially in the last year or so. So this is a historic election, and as the leader said this morning when he was to cast his vote, that the whole world is watching the Iranians take part in determining who is going to run the Iranian parliament, but also in determining the how Iran is going to take part in world affairs as well.
Sure. Mr. Sharara in Beirut, the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has called for high voter turnout. He says that a large turnout will disappoint the enemies and ill-wishers of the nation. Who does the leader mean by that? If you may unpack those comments for us, please.
Well, I don't suppose that there's a lot that I can say on the internal scene. Naturally, each country has its own sensitivities. But naturally, every country that has, like the leader said, ill-wishers, but I would say its own enemies or adversaries, these enemies or adversaries would love to see the establishment or administration enjoying unpopular support or not having the popular support that it should. So naturally, a country, when you take a country like Iran that has had to fight off enemies ever since its the Islamic Revolution in 1979, so you're talking about over four decades of constant fighting against adversaries, be it on the domestic front or on the international front, having to combat cultural warfare, having to combat, for every facet of life in Iran. So when you face such an enemy, naturally, the response, the best fitting response to be, would be that you still enjoy popular support. So it's actually quite interesting, like what you see each and every year on the 22 of Bahman or 11 February, the victory of the Islamic Revolution, which was not 2 weeks ago, not 3 weeks ago. the millions and millions of people that come down to the street every year to announce their support for the Islamic Revolution. And now, of course, naturally, each country has, like I said, its own sensitivities. People may choose not to vote, for example. Now, like I, regardless of whether or not this is an optimal choice for them to make, naturally, my response would be no, this is not. But that's another subject for another day. It means that there is support for the Islamic Revolution. It means that there is a great deal of belief in the Islamic Republic. It means that once again Iran's adversaries have gone home disappointed because they could not achieve their objectives. So we should not take this the concept of a high turnout in the elections at face value, because truly every single vote counts. Every family that decides to join the electoral process counts in further disappointing ill-wishers.
Back to Ms. Beauty on Tehran. The Islamic Republic brought something especially new to the Persian Gulf region. That was its democratic process. Frequent and regular elections across the board in villages, in rural areas. Talk to us about that aspect of the democratic process of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Yes, of course. Iran has a history of parliamentary movement back to the which goes back to the Constitutional Revolution. But the point is that when parliamentarism was introduced to Iran back then, during the time of the Qajar dynasty, it was actually a colonized parliamentary movement. Parliamentarism that was Eurocentric in nature, which was a system that basically try to bring people to power that would actually, for example, write the constitutional the constitution of that time in as a dictation of the Belgium constitution, for example. So we had this sort of history of parliamentarism in Iran, as in other colonial settings as they got independence, but which was very much colonized, which was a specific colonial parliamentary system, which was overseen by the colonial powers, which was actually directed in a specific Eurocentric direction. But with the Islamic Revolution, we actually entered a new era, an era of an independent democratic system which was based on Islamic principles and was not copied on other colonial systems with their own deficiencies. So here we have an independent system of having the will of the people being counted, having the people being participating in how the country is run, having people's voices being heard in terms of how the country is run. And as you said, this is something that is very much deficient in the West Asia region. We have many countries around us with which the United States actually has no problem, in which we see no electoral system in terms of how the country is run. So this is very much unique to the Islamic Republic, but the problem is that when it comes to elections in third world countries, countries like the United States have had this dual vision. Basically, if it is elections in a country which is an adversary, it is by definition considered to be unfair, considered to be unfree, and of course considered to be illegitimate. And the will of the people is never actually recognized as such. But if it is being conducted in another country which is actually friendly to the United States, then you see that country's elections and the electoral participation of the people is considered to be a sign of legitimacy. And of course, you in those conditions, usually, as it has been documented in many academic books, including in the book by Professor Chomsky and Professor Herman, Manufacturing Consent. It is very much elections that are controlled or overseen or hampered with on the side of the United States and the countries, of the like countries.
Sure. Mr. Shahada, you addressed the comments of Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei earlier about calling for massive voter turnout, but also top Iranian officials. They say huge turnout in the elections will give the country great advantages in the international arena. What advantages are they talking about?
Well, it depends on which countries you're referring to. Because if you're talking about a very adversarial countries like the United States, for example, or take, for example, Germany, France, some countries that have shown actual animosity towards Iran, I don't think it's really going to matter in this case. But there are certain countries that are not exactly nor friendly nor adversarial towards Iran. You're talking about neutral countries that reside in the gray area and actually look at the extent of popular support that any given administration has as an actual indicator for how well a certain system or establishment it's doing vis-a-vis its people. So I think they were referring to such a case. And that's on the one hand. Now, on the other hand, again, a high turnout is an indication in front of all, it's an indication on the international scene that this country, this establishment, this administration, this whatever you want to call it, this system, it actually enjoys popular support by the majority of its people and is therefore indicative of these people's willingness to adopt the system, to believe in it, to believe in meaningful change through the system, to believe in the actual democratic process that occurs within the system. So that in and of itself will make adversarial countries think twice about wanting to do anything with Iran. It could make some countries, perhaps even some who are adversarial, to a lesser extent than the United States or some of the let's say hardliner countries against Iran, it would make them think twice about wanting to take on Iran in terms of creating internal sedition, for example, because such an adventure would be I think they would believe that it would be more likely to lose and would therefore seek other avenues to tackle Iran. That's basically the gist of it.
Ms. Bedia, Iran has in the past had record turnouts come election day. I believe the average number is hovering just under 52%. Western media outlets, of course, were trying to portray that a very low voter turnout will occur during this round. What motives are they pursuing by presenting this type and pursuing this type of narrative?
Of course, as Mr. Sharar said, it is that what Western media are trying to do is exactly what the United States is trying to do, to create this picture of the Iranian, the Islamic Republic as a country that lacks public support. And as I said, it is something that from the very beginning of the Islamic Revolution, we have had this problem that every election we have had this, calculation on the part of the Western media that the Iranian people are not going to show up or that there is no, there is not going to be that much voter turnout. But then when we come to the at the end of the day, they see that the picture is different. But still, we see that this happens time and again with every election. But with this election especially, we have seen this very enthusiastic, this enthusiastic public movement on the part of the ordinary people and, people who are concerned about the health of this system of governance, that the enthusiasm to bring the people to come out to vote, we have seen that over the past couple of weeks, and it actually is paying out today, that we see that people are enthusiastic about participating in the future of their country, in who is going to run the parliament. And of course, that is a very important institution in the political system of Iran. It is as I said, the Western media are actually imitating or copying the framework, the framing that has been set up by the American government over the years regarding Iran. And this time, the same thing is happening, and we are witnessing the same instead of for them to wait and see what is going to happen, you see that they are trying to create this picture that voter turnout is going to be low. But, we have to wait and see what the results are.
Karim Sharada, one of the main goals of the Islamic Revolution was establishing political independence. Amidst all the hurdles and hindrances and sanctions that the Islamic Republic has managed to overcome, do you think that that goal was achieved, and has it been maintained over the past 4.5 decades?
Ever since the Islamic Revolution began, you've always had the same motto being repeated: neither East nor West, Islamic Republic. And to have such a motto being repeated throughout the Cold War is actually very significant, because here you have a people who were largely under a pro-American rule, and now suddenly you have ideologues presenting an entire worldview that was not just new to the world, but also somewhat novel in terms of what we had seen in the past decades before that, meaning you have an increasingly secular outlook towards the world. Religion is being cast aside by many. And so to have a people, millions of people, going to the streets and calling for a return not just to religion, but to culture, to traditionalism, it really means a lot to have. I mean, it really explains why Iran was one of the major revolutions that the world has known. You have the French Revolution, the Russian Revolution, and the Iranian Revolution. And what set the Iranian Revolution apart was that it was a cultural revolution. Now, back to your question. Has Iran achieved political independence? Yes. Has Iran been able not just to achieve political independence, but to... I mean, Iran has surpassed its goal. If the goal was just political independence, Iran is no longer just domestically politically independent, but has also actively sought to rid the region of American influence. And so it's not just political independence that it created for itself. It also provided the opportunity for other actors in the region, other actors who were simply sick and tired of American and Western influence in the region, American and Western subservience to the West, of being forced to abide by Western cultural norms and Western fashion and everything. I mean, being turned into a consumerist culture. This was an affirmation of life, not just independence. This was an affirmation of wanting to create, not consume. This was an affirmation of our capacities as peoples in the region,
sure,
to produce a new kind of outlook towards the world.
And Ms. Birya, staying on that topic, we can also turn our attention to the American enmity towards Iran. Why has there been this level of hostility coming from the United States towards the Islamic Republic? Is it because of Iran's independence, as we were just discussing right now? Is it because Iran is a force to be reckoned with in the region? Or is it because Iran has stood firm against the Israeli occupying regime and its destabilizing activities in the region?
It is all of the above, basically. If you look at U.S. relations with the world over the past 100 years, with each and every country of the world, and that is what Professor Silvan and Professor Majewski did in their book, U.S. Foreign Policy in Perspective, Clients, Enemies, and Empire, we see that the United States historically has started a complex process of enmity with any country that seeks systematic independence. That is an important word. It's not just independence, but it is systematic independence. And Iran's system of independence is very unique. It is a very dynamic and very complex and multi-layered system of independence. When you look at the views of Imam Khomeini and the views of Ayatollah Khamenei in this regard, it starts with the idea that independence is at the foundation of the being of any nation that wants to live according to the will of God. Basically, you cannot give in to the will, you cannot give in your agency completely to any power that is ungodly. And of course, we had this during the colonial era, we had this during the time of the bipolar world, and of course in the unipolar American world. So this is very foundational in the system of the political thought of Imam Khomeini and Ayatollah Khamenei, which is at the basis of this revolution and the Islamic Republic is a political system. But on the second layer, we need to, you know, the idea is that Iran needs to achieve internal strength and power in order to be independent. So independence means strengthening Iran from within, and part of that is the political process. You need to have a vibrant electoral system, you need to have a vibrant economy which is resilient, you need to have a vibrant cultural system. In each and every one of that, Iran has had progress and setbacks. So there is a system in the making. You know, when we talk about Iran's independence, we are not talking about some product that has been made by the victory of the revolution or any time after that. We are looking at a system that is living, and of course the people of Iran are part of that. If they participate in it, it is going to work, and if they don't, it's not going to work in terms of politics, in terms of economics, in terms of culture, in terms of security and everything. So that's why there is so much emphasis on the part of the leaders of the Islamic Revolution for the people to participate in every aspect of running this country. But then we have, the extra, national independence, which is about the region that Iran is, located in. It is about the Ummah of Islam. It is about the world that, Mr. Sharara was talking about, Iran has tried to rid this region of American influence. That is part of this system of independence that Iran has sought to create and to pursue over the years. And of course, as I said, it is a system in the making because of the goals that are there that we still need to reach. You know, when we can talk about, the problem of the presence of the Israeli regime in this country, in this region, having been solved, we can say that Iran has basically approached this goal. Yeah. We can talk about independence of this region as a whole, we can say that Iran has approached that goal of independence. But it is the Iranian people are part of that system, and okay, they have to be on the ground for it to work.
Sorry to jump in there. We're running short of time for tonight's program. Allow me to thank my guests, academic and political analyst Hakim Esaghlai Bedia, joining us from Tehran, and thanks to Iranian affairs expert Karim Sharara speaking to us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. And a special thanks to you for staying with us on Spotlight. It's good night for now.
From East to West. throughout the vast land of Iran. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
Palestinians in Rafah ask the world to stop the Zionist regime's invasion. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Palestine Chronicle wrote, "A displaced Palestinian in Rafah told the Palestine Chronicle, 'Stop the killing, stop the occupation's crimes, and restore our lives.'" The Zionist regime's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said that Israeli occupation forces will invade the city of Rafah in the southern Gaza Strip, despite international calls to abandon the plans. World leaders and human rights groups have repeatedly warned against a catastrophic ground offensive in the overcrowded city, where an estimated 1.5 million displaced Palestinians have been pushed to escape horrific Israeli regime bombardment across the Gaza Strip. The Palestine Chronicle spoke to displaced Palestinians who are currently sheltered in makeshift refugee camps in southern city. Khawar al-Awja told the Palestine Chronicle, "Every day we hear statements from occupation leaders about imminent invasion of the city of Rafah in the southern Gaza Strip." He added, "Moreover, the occupation links the invasion of Rafah to the completion of the invasion of Khan Yunis city. These statements create fear and terror for more than 1.5 million Palestinians who have been displaced to the tents of Rafah over 80 days ago." Al-Awja explained that all the displaced Palestinians in Rafah left their homes in the north, in Gaza City and in the central regions to flee from the Zionist regime's airstrikes. He said, "The occupation declared Rafah a safe area and asked us to evacuate to it. That didn't turn out to be the case at all. We have been living in these tents in Rafah for over 80 days now, without water or food. Rainwater flooded the tents several times, and our children were exposed to cold weather," Al-Awja continued. "Despite all of this, we chose to stay in the tents to preserve our lives and the lives of our children. Now, the occupation has been threatening us for days, claiming that they will invade Rafah." He added, "But we will stay in Rafah, and we will not leave the city except to return to our homes. We are tired of war and bombardment, and we are looking for security, but we cannot find it anywhere in the Gaza Strip." Samahar Al-Ghan, another Palestinian currently displaced in Rafah, told the Palestine Chronicle, "Everyone knows that the occupation is working to displace the people of the Gaza Strip to Sinai, and this is what the occupation leadership announced from the early days of the war. The occupation pushed us to migrate towards the southern Gaza Strip, then to the Egyptian border. Now it threatens to invade Rafah to push people to migrate to Sinai. But people want to return to their homes. They do not want to leave Gaza," she added. Al-Ghan recalled the journey she and her family undertook some weeks ago. She said, "We fled from the north to Rafah City, but we will not flee from Gaza, and we will not migrate from Gaza. Every moment, we dream of returning to our homes. We will never leave Gaza.
We were born in Gaza, and we choose to die in it rather than migrate from it. Commenting on the repeated threats by the occupation to invade Rafah, Alon told the Palestine Chronicle that she expects the world to translate words into action. She said, "We want real movements to stop the war and ensure a safe return to our homes. We want a strong international interventions to stop the occupation's crimes, end this war, work on rebuilding Gaza, and ensuring a decent life for the besieged residents of the Gaza Strip."
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.